All right, so thanks a lot, Marcus and Matt, for the invitation, the opportunity to speak. I'm going to talk about two main pieces of work. One is some fairly old work that did with Cosmin Uderdeck and Joe Emerson. A lot of it actually while I was at Perimeter in 2009. And it's just sort of been, well, we published the three-slit case, I guess in 2010. The N-slit case has sort of been languishing around because you'll see. I'm also going to, towards the end, talk about some work with Marcus Mueller and Cosmin on a characterization of quantum and Jordan algebraic theories that uses the assumption of no higher order interference as one of the postulates, although I'll spend less time on that. Okay, so I guess everybody here probably knows about higher order interference. Is that, maybe I won't spend as much time as I otherwise would. On introduction, it's probabilistic interference rather than interference of physical quantities like the magnitude of a wave. And Feynman also stressed, so he talked about this in the quantum part of the lectures on physics, that quantum information interference is related to disturbance by information gathering. In particular, if you have two paths in an interferometer interfering, and you start collecting information about which way your particle went, you wash out the interference pattern. So it's potentially related to the phenomenon in quantum theory that gathering information disturbs a state. Okay, Raphael has defined this hierarchy of interference measures for k-slit experiments. You probably all know that if the kth is zero, so are all higher ones, and quantum theory has third order zero, but can have second order non-zero. Classical has even the second order zero, and the second order is, of course, the first order that's really worth calling interference. okay, so in this talk, we're going to formulate a notion of a k-slit experiment, interference experiment, I should say, in the general probabilistic theories framework, and adapt Raphael's hierarchy of interference measures to such experiments. We'll also formulate a notion of what it means to have an irreducible coherence between a set of k faces of the state space. And then our main result is going to be that kth order interference always arises from a certain kind of irreducible coherence between faces. I'll talk about implications for state tomography. Another result that I think was announced in the 2010 Foundations of Physics paper, but is that Jordan algebraic theories have no third order interference as well. And this is proved for a little bit more restricted class of interference, definition of interference experiments than our most general one. And then, as I mentioned, we'll talk about this derivation. So here's the references. This is the Foundations of Physics paper. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to put in the archive references, which are the most useful. This is an unpublished thing that I think we've referred to a few times, and maybe some of you have seen parts of it. It will be on the archive very soon, I hope. Some of the stuff is also in Cosmin's doctoral dissertation, which you can find online. And then the derivation of quantum theory and the characterization of Jordan algebraic theories is in this paper in New JPhys, which is open access. You can even see the spiffy typeset version for free. okay, we need a more general framework, I would argue, because quantum theory doesn't have higher order interference. So if we want to get a theoretical handle on it and maybe get a better idea of how to look for it in experiments, we might want some idea of how it would show up in a consistent theory. And the general probabilistic theories framework is commonly used nowadays to study informational and physical properties of quantum theory and information processing, and also maybe to formulate possible new physics beyond quantum theory, but maybe including quantum theory as some subsector. it's very flexible and broad, allows all kinds of wacky theories, but they're not so wacky that they're not probabilistically consistent, which is surprisingly easy to get into if you start doing ad hoc things like saying, well, let's raise the modulus of the wave function to some other power than 2, or let's have a nonlinear term in the Schrodinger equation. You got to be very careful. If you do something like that, you're going to have to adjust a whole lot of other things to make sure that you still have something that's going to give you a consistent theory where you get probabilities for measurement outcomes that are between 0 and 1 and so on. Okay, so a theory is basically a set of systems in this framework. And a system is specified by a convex set of allowed states, allowed measurements, allowed dynamics compatible with each measurement outcome. Since you have these dynamics, you could view it as a category where the dynamics are morphisms. And that would mean there's sort of dynamics or transformations that can go between different types of objects. That's okay. That can be things like partial tracing in quantum theory, looking at a reduced state and so forth. We're not going to deal with this category theoretic view. And we're also not going to talk much about composite systems, but that is usually part of the GPT framework as well. When you do that, then you start talking about symmetric monoidal categories, perhaps. Okay, so to be a little more specific, the normalized states of a system. So I'm going to talk about the mathematical framework first, and then on the next slide, maybe relate it a little bit to a theorist's character of how you would arrive at it through experiment. It's going to be a character. So there's a convex compact set, omega. I'm going to call it omega sub A if we want to label different systems. In actual fact, we'll deal mostly with one system, so this label won't be around much. Omega, this is not Raphael's history set. This is something a little different. Of dimension d minus 1, let's say, embedded in a real vector space of dimension d as the base of a regular cone. So let's say this is a disk, right? That's the state space, normalized state space of real quantum theory. That's in two-dimensional. I embed it in R3, and I make it the basis of this, you know, ice cream cone kind of thing. So here's omega. And I'm going to either call this ambient vector space A or V, and this cone will be V plus for positive. It's a positive cone. Okay. What is a cone? It's just a convex cone is just a subset of a real vector space that's closed under non-negative scalar multiplication and addition. That makes it convex. Okay, the positive semi-definite matrices are the thing to keep in mind if you're a quantum theorist. Okay, so these are the normalized states. We want to take states and have something that tells us if we do a measurement, what's the probability of the various outcomes we could have. So measurement outcomes are linear functionals from the state space to the reals called effects. And we want their values on this compact set to be in 0, 1 because they're supposed to be probabilities. And then we have this unit effect, and it evaluates to 1 on this base. And so we can just think of there being some big plane. This is where u equals 1, and it cuts through this thing, this cone, and slices out the normalized states. But it's handy, just like it is in quantum theory, to have unnormalized states as well. Okay.
I'm a bit confused. Like,
yeah.
So you call A the system, and then you embed it in A.
Yeah, so we're sort of making the letter A do double duty. A is the ambient vector space, but we're also going to use it as the name of the system. Okay. On the other hand, we're only going to ever deal with one system here, so the name doesn't really matter.
Okay. Yeah. So V plus is the cone of A plus.
Yeah. V plus or A plus is the cone. I mean, at some point I'm going to start calling this vector space V for vector, and then it'll be V plus, or, you know, maybe if I'm unlucky, I'll mix them both. But, yeah.
Okay.
Right. So a measurement we can think of as just an index set of effects, E sub I, and they add up to this unit effect, just the analog of a POVM. Guarantees that the probabilities add up to 1 when you evaluate them on states, no matter what state you evaluate it on. Okay, these effects, since they have to be non-negative on states, they're also non-negative on all non-negative multiples of states, so they generate the dual cone of functionals that are non-negative on A+. And it's very common to represent this dual cone in the same vector space as the primal cone, the cone generated by the states, and then represent functional evaluation as an inner product. So you'll see that a lot. Okay, this positive cone is regular, which means it's topologically closed. It's generating, that means its linear span is the entire ambient vector space. It's convex, and it's pointed. That means basically it's not a wedge. It contains no full line, right? I mean, you could have something that was closed under non-negative multiplication, and it would look like this, you know, and continue in both directions, and there'd be this full vector subspace. Maybe this is zero vector subspace there. That's often called a wedge. It's a non-pointed cone is another way of saying it. We want it to be pointed because when we slice it, we want this compact convex set. So since we start with compact convex set, it's pointed. Okay. So for example, for a qubit, it's a ball instead of this disk. It's just a block ball. That's omega. And you get your ordinary like Lorentz cone over that block ball. For, you know, four-dimensional, or Q-trit, it's a little harder to draw, but and it's not a ball anymore. But the ball isn't a bad picture to keep in mind. Okay. How does one arrive at this structure? Well, the sort of character is that we get it from a phenomenological description. So we think of pairs of preparations and measurement outcomes, and we want a map from that takes every measurement outcome, every pair of a measurement outcome and a preparation, let's say, and gives us the probability of getting that outcome when we prepare the state in this way. And then you get this omega, and you get some set of effects, which is, let's see, okay, let me define one more thing. This cone makes a vector space into an ordered linear space. We just say A is greater than or equal to B if A minus B is in the positive cone. It's just a generalization of the standard ordering of the reals. And it makes A into an ordered linear space. What does that mean? It means you could add inequalities and multiply them by positive scalars, just like you can if there are inequalities between real numbers. Okay. The reason I said that is because I wanted to describe the effects. The set of effects are I wrote as an interval 0, u, and that's the point. The point is that's just the set of x in dual space, let's say, that are between 0 and u. That's what guarantees that their probabilities are bounded between 0 and 1 on every state. So that's the full set of mathematically consistent effects. In a particular theory, if you just have some set of preparations and measurement outcomes, you might not get all the possible effects. You might get some convex subset of them. For sort of phenomenological reason or operational reasons, we expect these to be convex. Because you just imagine flip a coin and do one preparation or the other, you get the convex combination of the state. Flip a coin and do one of two measurements, the outcomes will be the convex combinations of the associated outcomes. So these things should always be convex, but this might not be the full set of effects. We're going to go ahead and assume it is the full set of effects, and it's something that would be nice to relax, but it's a lot easier to deal with. In any case, it's going to be closed under, if you have an effect in there, you have to have the unit effect minus it, because every effect has to be part of a complete measurement, and you can always just coarse grain the other outcomes to get this. Okay, in constructing these things, typically there's empirics involved, but really there's some theory too, because you can't do every possible one of an uncountable set of experiments, and well, you know, some of them are actually going to be undecidable. So it's somewhat idealized, but it's bringing in phenomenology as well. Okay. So one caveat, if we're looking to extend existing theories, and we must be if we're studying higher order interference, you might want to look for probabilistic distinctions between measurement and preparation procedures that your existing theory didn't make room for. Or you might even need new procedures. So stuff you thought was the same preparations that you thought led to the same state, when you look closer, perhaps you'll find that they're really different. Okay, we also need transformations on the state space. We're mostly going to be interested in ones that take a system to itself. This is a typo, since I have a system A to system B, that should be B plus. So they're going to have to take positive elements to positive elements. And the value of this normalization functional should not increase. We're going to allow it to decrease, because if it decreases, we say, well, this transformation doesn't happen with unit probability, but the value of u of x on a normalized statement, sorry, the value u of tx on a normalized state x is telling us the probability with which it happens. And then maybe we can put a bunch of these transformations together that add up to one that preserves normalization and actually then takes the normalized state space into itself. And that's the generalization of a trace-preserving quantum operation. These are the trace non-increasing quantum operations. Reversible transformations are even more special than this, although they do have this property. They have T of omega A actually equal to itself. So they right, they don't take it into itself. They sort of preserve the whole state space. It's the generalization of unitary transformations in quantum theory. Rho goes to U, rho U dagger for rho density matrix. Okay, and we could specify a convex semigroup of allowed transformations, et cetera. Examples, I think maybe I'll skip this. Oh, if you have one wing of a Popescu-Rohrlich box, Alice and Bob each have it, can be thought of as having a state space that's where omega A is a square. So that's kind of cute. I mentioned you can represent both the primal and dual cone in the same space with an inner product. In the very special case where you can do it in such a way that the primal cone and the dual cone are identical, we call the system self-dual. It's very unusual, but quantum theory and, let's say, finite dimensional classical theory have this as well. So what's finite dimensional classical theory? Omega A is just the probability simplex, and the cone is just the positive orthon in some Rn. Okay, so any questions so far? Yeah, Raphael.
Sort of general. I'm just wondering how much theory is involved. You said theory was involved, intervened at certain points, like assuming you could measure everyone in that comfortable. Another place where I'm wondering whether theory intervened is in the very beginning assumption that your state space is convex. I mean, that you can form any convex combination of states, and that's still a state.
I mean, you could consider that to be a piece of theory. I think of it as, this is an operational theory for people doing experiments, interacting with systems, and if they want to perform one or another operation to a decent approximation, they can make the performance conditional on some random outcome that they generate somehow. So, if you don't think one can really...
But there's something, I'm not quite sure how to put my finger on it. You're assuming every state can be produced by an appropriate preparation, and that this kind of assumption, this kind of convex combination of the preparation.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean,
I don't know.
There's some theory to it, but it still allows you to make a whole lot of different shapes, let's put it that way. So, so we're generalizing the density matrix formalization of quantum theory. But Rob has a toy model where he doesn't allow arbitrary convex combinations, so it's definitely not completely uncontroversial, I guess. It is something you can relax.
Maybe the thing that you could demand would be any probability distributions you want to use to combine preparations into a new state. Demand that those are probability distributions that could be the result of some measurement. You could actually implement a measurement for which the distribution of outcomes gave you that. So that would be a sort of way of trying to restrict convex combination in a principled fashion.
Yeah, I suppose I'm also questioning whether every state can be prepared. pair.
Oh, in fact, I don't think it can. I mean, that's why I put operational or aspirational in there in a side comment, which I didn't mention. But, you know, I mean, that's what quantum computing is about, right? It's like trying to prepare a lot more states than we used to be able to, even though still exponentially less than the whole Hilbert space of a large number of qubits. So, yeah, this is really formalizing, you know, you're kind of abstracting a quantum information theorist's picture of quantum theory, where maybe they really are interested in information theoretic stuff and not even computational stuff. So they have this sort of fantasy that you can prepare any state. Okay, I mean, I still think it's useful, but yeah, that is an important point.
I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah, that is a very important point. I mean, there's a lot of physics that isn't in here about actual quantum systems and the actual handles you have on them. So extremal points of a convex set are ones that can't be written as a non-trivial convex combination of things in the set. So here it's everything on the boundary. If we have a classical trit whose omega looks like this, it's these three points. All extremal points are faces. Oh, rats, I've gone ahead. Okay. So what's a face of a convex set? It's a subset such that if you can write it as a convex combination of other things in the larger set, a non-trivial convex combination, then those things must also be in the face S. We're only going to be really interested in exposed faces, and those are intersections of the set with a supporting hyperplane, right? And so a hyperplane is supporting if it has to intersect the set, but all of the set has to be on one side of it if it's not in the intersection. That's basically what it is. So this in 2D, here's a hyperplane. Hyperplanes always have one less than the ambient dimension. And we've picked out this face, which happens to be this this extremal point. If we tilted our hyperplane, we could pick out this face, which is no longer an extremal point. It's a whole edge. So that's a critical concept for this talk, is exposed faces. Of course, they're convex, and the exposed ones satisfy this definition as well. The non-exposed faces are not of too much interest to us. Okay, we're going to say the exposed face generated by S is just the smallest exposed face that contains it. And now here's the main reason we're interested in them. If we take effects and we define, like an effect E, and we define its zero set and its one set as the set of states on which the effect is zero and the set of states on which it's one, those are exposed faces of the state space. And all exposed faces, in fact, have that form. So what they are, they're conclusively excludable or confirmable subsets of the state space. There's some measurement outcome that will say, you've definitely got it. Or another measurement outcome that will say, you definitely don't have it. Not necessarily unique. But, so for informational purposes, processing purposes, that kind of thing is important. Okay, extremal points, I started talking about that. Right, we'll come back to atoms. Extremal rays of this cone are just the rays of multiples of an extremal point. So here we've got an extremal point. Here's an extremal ray. There aren't really any extremal points of a cone except a pointed cone except for zero. But the ray is an extremal ray is a useful concept. So examples of faces. In classical, here's our simplex, and the faces are just, you know, this, all the edges, and the whole thing. In quantum theory, the exposed faces, and all the faces are exposed, actually, they correspond to subspaces of the Hilbert space, and they just consist of the positive semi-definite operators, or the density operators, if you want faces of omega, that are only supported in that Hilbert subspace. So I should have said subspace is S of Hilbert space. S isn't the face. The face is determined by S. But the face is a set of mixed states. Okay. So does that make some sense? Okay. Faces form a lattice, and that's going to be important to us. What's a lattice? It's a partially ordered set. such that every pair of elements has a least upper bound, which we call the join, and a greatest lower bound, which is called the meet. And they're written this way, looks like or and, because in fact, in the lattice of, let's say, subsets of a finite set, which could model a logic, they would be or and in that logic. Okay, so the exposed faces form of any convex set are a lattice if you order it by set inclusion. So a set is less than or equal to B if it is a subset of B. Could be equal to B. So meet is intersection, and join is just the exposed face generated by the union, which is not, in general, the union itself, unless the thing is a Boolean lattice. Okay, maybe I'll not draw a bunch of examples since I want to keep moving. So according to this definition, the empty set is a face. For a cone, we're going to just exclude it by convention. We'll keep it in there for omega. And the reason is that the face lattices of the convex set and the cone are isomorphic if we associate a face of the convex set with the face of the cone that is just all non-negative multiples of things in the face. And we associate the empty set with the point, the singleton, zero. So, you know, if I have my probability simplex, and then maybe I've got my, I don't know, my cone over it, which is just this orthant, then if I take this face of omega, I get this quadrant as the face of the cone over this face of omega. It's an example of that association. All right. The face lattice is a bounded lattice, and we normally call the upper bound 1 and the lower bound 0. So 1 is the entire set, and 0 is either 0 or the empty set, depending whether we're talking about the normalized state space or the cone. deciding whether to come back to complementation. I think I'll skip complementation for now, and if we need it, well, let's just do it. So we say X prime is a complement of X if X join X prime is the top element and X meet X prime is the bottom element. It's not necessarily unique in a general lattice. Complementation is a choice of distinguished complement for every element. An orthocomplementation is one that's involutive, so X prime prime is X, and it reverses the order. It's still not necessarily unique. There might be two different ways of assigning a complement to everything that satisfy this. And orthocomplemented lattices satisfy De Morgan's laws. You can move the complement outside and flip the connective to the opposite connective. All right, so let's take the set of, now let's talk about Boolean lattices. These are so-called distributive lattices where join distributes over meet. And we're going to be interested in finite ones, and they're all isomorphic to the set of subsets of a finite set. Join is union, meet's intersection. And there's a unique complementation. You just take everything in the set that isn't in S, the ambient set that isn't in S, and that's the complement. Okay, and these are actually the face lattices of finite dimensional classical systems. They're Boolean algebras, which are also kind of associated with classical logic. Okay, orthomodularity. Well, here's the orthomodular law. So if you have an orthocomplemented lattice, and F is and you have the property that whenever F is less than G, G is can be made up as F joined with G meet F complement, it's orthomodular. And we just think of this orthomodular law as saying, when F is below G, then F has a complement relative to G. It's just, so in the Boolean case, it would just be take G's intersection with F complement. I mean, here it is, right? Here's G, here's F, And here is, this is G, this is F, which is less than G, so it's contained in it. And this is G, G intersect F complement, right? I mean, here's, this big thing might be X, so F complement is everything outside of here. Here's G intersect F complement. And sure enough, the join of this and this, which is just their union, is you get G back. So an orthocomplemented lattice does not by any means have to be distributive, but it has this property that it does behave a lot like Abelian algebra when you're looking at just the relationship between an element that's and an element that's above it. Okay, why is this interesting? Because the closed subspaces of a real or complex Hilbert space, or a so-called quaternionic quote-unquote Hilbert space, are orthomodular lattices. So they were proposed in quantum logic as an appropriate abstraction of this so-called logic of quantum theory, just the idea of an orthomodular lattice itself. Okay. Let's think a bit about perfectly distinguishable states. Maybe come back to this. I don't think it's that important at the moment. Well, let's do it. So let's say a set of states are perfectly distinguishable if there are effects that make up a measurement or maybe a submeasurement such that effect I on state J is delta IJ. So if you get effect I, you know that state I was prepared. And then we call a set of states perfectly distinguishable if every selection of one state from each set is perfectly distinguishable. So if I take two orthogonal subspaces of Hilbert space and take the density matrices supported on one and the density matrices supported on another, on the other, that's a pair of perfectly distinguishable states because I can always tell if I'm going to pick one state from one and one state from the other, I can always tell which of those states I prepared by measuring which subspace. Okay, so here's a proposition. It's probably been known for ages. If you have two perfectly distinguishable sets, if you have n perfectly distinguishable sets in this sense, the exposed faces they generate are perfectly distinguishable. And that's really a large part of the reason why exposed faces are of so much interest. Okay, now we're going to use the notion of faces to generalize interference experiments. And the idea is going to be that if we have a multi-slit experiment, let's make another slit. So we can have various combinations of slits open. And every subset of the set of all possible slits in our experiment is going to be associated with a face of the state space. And, you know, if we have two slits open versus one, the one slit face that is one of the two slits that we open, that's going to be contained within the face associated with two slits and so forth. Before we talk about interference, let's talk about coherence, though. So we say, let's say we have a set of linearly independent faces of the positive cone. So we'll say there's irreducible coherence between them if their join in the face lattice is not a subset of their the linear span of their union. And so I think the simple example to keep in mind is quantum theory. So let's write our density matrix. Let's say we have two subspaces, make them orthogonal, and just block our density matrix according to subspace one and subspace two. So the density matrices that are non-zero in here but zero outside, that's F1, let's say. And the ones that are non-zero in here, that's F2. What's the linear span? It's the block diagonal density matrices. What is the face associated with, so we have, this is F1 and F2. What's F1 join F2? Well, S1 and S2 span the whole Hilbert space. So the face associated with them is the whole thing, all density matrices. It's not the linear span of these. It's got these extra subspaces in it that correspond to coherence. And so this is generalizing that idea. Yeah.
Are you saying that when you have two slits open, the what you measure is the sum of the individuals plus the integrals term?
Well, that's what it is in the case of two.
Right, and so yeah. what you just said is a generalization of that to n.
Yeah. Now I'm talking about coherence, so these spaces don't necessarily have to be associated with slits. They don't even have to be orthogonal in this distinguishable in this definition. But yeah, that's exactly how it works in the two-slit experiment. And you know, it, classically, you just all like the density matrix is diagonal. There's nothing off diagonal, and the faces are just subsets. And even if they overlap, you never get out of the linear span when you take the join, because it's just the union. So just using this idea from convexity, we have a way of generalizing the notion of coherence that works pretty well for arbitrary theories, and you don't have to have a Hilbert space and talk about superpositions and stuff. So that's good. Okay. So now for interference experiments, we need to associate slits or paths with transformations. That's going to be key to our notion of interference. And we're going to choose a particular kind of transformation, which we're going to call projection. Key thing is it's idempotent, so P squared is equal to P. And we'll say a K-slit interference experiment, and I'm thinking maybe I should use the word interferometer here, but I mean, I feel sort of guilty using like experimental sounding names for mathematical things, but in operational theory, we do that all the time, right? We already use the word measurement, so. Okay, so an interferometer or an interference experiment is an index set of projections, and it's indexed by the subset of some subsets of some finite set. okay, so if it's a K-slit interference experiment, K is the cardinality of this set. And I may sometimes switch back and forth between K and N. I'm sorry about that. In both cases, they're going to refer to the total number of slits in the experiment. And we want them to satisfy the following conditions. So the positive image of each projection is a face. Okay, that's not true for arbitrary projections, right? So for instance, the decoherence operator, which just throws these off diagonal blocks away, is an idempotent positive operator, but its image is not a face. Right, these block diagonal density matrices are not a face of the quantum state space. We're going to require that it's a face. We might be able to relax that a bit and still do all right, but for now we do this. We'll call it F sub J. All right, and then the different projectors. So these, each of these subsets, you can think of that associated with having a different set of slits open in your experiment. And then the projectors associated with different sets of slits commute, and their product is just the projector associated with the intersection of those slit sets. and then we want to think of the, you know, having a bunch of slits open as kind of a coherently coarse-grained, so the projector associated with that should be kind of a coherent coarse-graining of the transformation that's associated with the individual slits. And the coherence is expressed by the fact that we don't add them up. We take the join of the faces, and then we have some projector whose image is that join. In general, if the theory is not classical, PJ is not going to be the sum of all of the piots. Okay, and this is just because it would sort of be silly. I mean, you don't have to have it, but if J isn't the empty set, we're going to say its projector isn't the zero projector. So it's like going to be saying we don't have slits that are always blocked. okay. An example of such projectors, of course, so we have these subsets of Hilbert space. Let's say Q1 is the orthogonal projector onto S1 in Hilbert space, and Q2 is the orthogonal projector. Then we might have P1 takes rho to Q1 row Q1. P2 row is Q2 row Q2. It's easy to see that P1 plus P2 row is not, it is the decoherence operator. It's not the projector onto this larger space. All right, so pause for questions here. Yeah, Marcus.
Maybe just related to this topic of this conference. So I wonder whether like the first and the third condition, I mean, probably we have even discussed ourselves about that, but whether that could be reformulated in a more operational way. I mean, say there's something like a measurement that gives probability one if it came through that slit. And the measurement for a bunch of slits is something like the sum of the effects.
That will be true. Yeah. That will be true. I didn't want to formulate it entirely that way, although we did formulate it that way in the paper with Cosman.
Kind of,
Because, I don't know, I think it's important to have these transformations, and so I think that John and Karen, for instance, used an effect-based version, which they got out of our paper. And for us, it wasn't a problem because all these spaces were associated with a unique transformation that was even satisfying much stronger conditions than this. So I think you have to be careful if you have an effect. So they got that certain theories that probably shouldn't had arbitrary orders of interference and things like that. In the work with Cosman and Joe, we required these conditions. So for our main theorem, this is all we need. In Cos's thesis, this stronger condition that the things are duals of Alfsein-Schultz compressions was assumed. But you don't need all that strength for the main theorem. Just a sort of cute aside, this map from subsets, right, from the power set of this I to faces is an injective homomorphism from the Boolean lattice of subsets into the face lattice of omega. So I want to say that idempotence is kind of a weak non-disturbance by the slits condition. Okay, if you're the kind of state that's already been through the slit and you're sent through it again, you're not changed. And I already sort of discussed that this projector associated with the union of these sets of slits being open is kind of a coherent coarse graining of the transformations. Coherent meaning we're not collecting information about which subset or which slits within that the thing passed through. Okay, so here's where we generalize Waffle's things. Yes. Should I go back?
Yeah, you can go. It's not necessary. You define the projector as just by being idempotent. Is there some, but quantum mechanically you would presumably think, and you said, orthogonal projection. So is there something hidden in the definition of transformation that make it the orthogonal?
Well, in quantum mechanics, well, let me just say, in the definition of transformation, it has to be norm non-increasing, normalization non-increasing, and positive. So it has to take states to states, or to multiples of states. In quantum theory, so this is one kind of projection, but it doesn't have to be that way. The operation that takes all states to a fixed state, that's a projection.
Right.
Its image is not, in general, a face, although it could be. No, actually, it is a face, yeah. Yeah, so that would be one whose image is a face. You might have trouble fitting it into this framework, let me say. So I don't know, does that help at all? It has to be a operationally reasonable thing. It can't increase probabilities.
Probably haven't taken all the definitions in, but is it a consequence of your definitions that what you call a projector here, when you specialize to the quantum state space and so on, is that an orthogonal projector?
I mean,
it's realized by this Q.
That's not the only way to realize it.
You get another example where it just takes everything to one.
Yeah, that.
So this is something more general than.
Yes, it is.
Than an orthogonal.
It is. Yeah.
But the slits are orthogonal. In some sense,
I mean, in a sense, this condition is going to enforce that the images, the faces associated to disjoint sets of slits are going to be orthogonal. So there's a lot more structure in here than just saying they're projections.
Right.
So that's where the orthogonality should come in.
I remember right, positivity of the transformation in quantum theory literally translates into positivity of the operator, and I think in complex Hilbert spaces, positive operators automatically are orthogonal, right?
Hermitian.
I mean, you might be able to view them as Hermitian if you are looking at like a Choi representation of some sort, but. Yeah, maybe I should go on. Just to say something as a projection is fairly general. Like I was saying, the orthogonality of the slits is more ensured by this condition. We could allow for these spaces to intersect. This is just what we needed for our theorem. And I think the idea might be it's okay if they intersect as long as they all do the same thing on the intersection. That's not going to create any spurious interference. And the commutation is probably going to ensure that they more or less do that. So they don't have to be orthogonal, but it doesn't hurt for understanding. It doesn't hurt to think of these images as orthogonal faces or faces that just intersect in zero, for instance. Okay. Wait, was there anything useful there?
Yeah.
Okay, now we talked about that. Okay. So, getting to porting Raphael's notions to this framework, we can define this PK. So I'm just going to talk about K-slit experiments and whether or not they have kth order interference. You could also talk about N bigger than K, and it's all going to go pretty much the same, but let's stick to this. Okay, so let's define this thing, which is the signed sum of all of the projectors associated with proper subsets of this index set. So we don't have the all slits open projector, but we have all the other slits. And then we have these combinatorial, these signs, which are just like they are in Raphael's definition of the quantum measure. So things about this operator, it's idempotent. Okay, important open question is whether this is necessarily positive. Because what this is like the operator that projects onto the subspace where there is no kth order interference, right? We have all these k minus one and smaller slit projectors, but we never have a term that corresponds to having all the slits open. And so our basic idea is if you hit the state with this and there's anything left, it's going to have kth order interference. If this zaps everything, there's no kth order interference. So the reason it's interesting whether it's necessarily positive is that if it's positive, it represents a reasonable physical transformation in your general theory that could actually happen and represent some process that's projecting you onto a lower order interference subspace. For instance, the second order subspace, like maybe quantum theory. And so it might be an explanation or an excuse for why you're not seeing third order interference. All right, some examples. Of course, if the set, you just have two slits, then we've talked about this. This thing is just P1 plus P2. It is the decoherence projector, P1 plus P2, that just pulls out the diagonal blocks and throws off the coherences. Um, here's P3. We take all the two slip projectors and just subtract off all the one slip projectors. Okay. So we define a kth order interference expression for measurement outcome E with respect to a fixed experiment or interferometer and a fixed input state omega as just looking at the difference between all slits open and this funny sum when applied to the input state, and then evaluating the output, the final effect at it. You can think this effect is like the location on the screen. Different notation for the same thing. We might say the interference, kth order interference pattern produced by state omega and final observable E sub j, where these maybe add up to the identity. So these are like all the different positions on the screen. It's just a function from like the screen position to this difference, this interference expression. All right, and then of course, if that function is always zero for every state and every output, then there's no interference in this experiment or with this interferometer. Okay, so I mean, it's pretty easy to see that if these two things are equal, this is always going to be zero. So this first part of this theorem is just trivial. There's no interference in this experiment for any input state and output effect, if and only if the projector associated with all the slits being open is equal to this funny sine sum. And that's equivalent to there being no irreducible coherence with respect to the faces of cardinality k minus 1. So the faces where we have one slit shut. Okay, and when I say i.e. f sub I lies in the linear span of the union of these spaces, that's no irreducible coherence, right? If the linear span is a proper subspace of the linear space spanned by this, then there is coherence. And the extra dimensions here are needed to describe the behavior of the system under multiple slit experiments, k-slit experiments. Okay, it should extend straightforwardly if we have more than n slits and we want to limit ourselves to k-slit experiments. So in this paper, which I'll talk about next, I guess, we did the k+3 case. I will skip discussions of why this stuff's true, 2-slit, 3-slit. Maybe this is kind of cute. Simple example with third-order interference from this great book by Alfsén and Schultz. They didn't talk about interference, but you can use their example. Every face is part of an n equals 2 or n equals 3 slit interference experiment. And the 3-slit experiment, whose faces are generated by subsets of the 3 vertices of this equatorial triangle, has third-order interference. For any initial state that's not in the xy plane and any final two outcome measurement, where so you can think of a measurement as sort of a set of parallel, well, how to put it? Well, let's just say it this way. So there's some subspace which is the zero set of an effect. Yeah, it's a hyperplane. So if you have a two outcome measurement, you can always pick one so that it just squeezes the state space. The zero set of one effect, which is the one set of the other, squeezes, touches at one place and vice versa. And so if you make the tangency not in the equatorial plane of these zero sets and one sets of the effects, you're sensitive to this z dimension. And on the other hand, if you take the projectors onto all of these faces, or associated with the faces, the size 2 subset faces of this 3 set of slits, you're going to project into this equatorial plane and you'll destroy the component of the state in this z direction. So that's kind of a somewhat contrived example where you have, of course, this theory down in this xy plane is in fact classical, but you have an extension that has third order interference. And so you can imagine, I mean, actually, since we don't need have other, you know, Alf Sander Schultz's other interests, we really only need one point above and one point below. We could have a hexahedron, still have third order interference. If you want quantum theory to be lying within here, you could just take the convex hull of the eight-dimensional state space of a Q-trip, and again, two points on either side. You want the maximally mixed state, probably, maybe not even, to be in the in their convex hull. And that should be, you know, I mean, it's sort of a very contrived extension of quantum theory because there's only one more dimension, and you might be able to cleverly, you know, do better. But it is an extension. Okay. And all these examples, just projecting down onto this plane is positive. And so it does represent a potential sort of higher order decoherence process. And I mentioned this open question. Is PK, is that projector always positive when K is greater than or equal to 3? P2 is. Marcus and I spent a little time when I was in Heidelberg, I don't know, early last year, trying to prove that this was always positive and didn't manage to do it, even for P3. But it's a good question. Maybe we can think about it here. Okay, more general transformations. Well, you know, if you look at classical theory and you have general substochastic maps, if you just naively extend the definitions, and maybe we have this rule that you add the maps, and that's MJ, you will get I2 and other orders not equal to zero if you just naively extend the definitions. But if the stochastic maps are diagonal, so it's like they attenuate states, but they don't, like, move the pure states around, they'll still have the naive extension, still gives I2 equal to zero. And similarly, if you do a similar thing for quantum theory, where you take maybe positive semi-definite operators here that aren't projectors as your transformations, and then these should all be Fs, I'm sorry. Fj is the square root of the sum of the squares of these things. If they all commute, you still get your I3 looking like zero. I should check that calculation, but I think at one point I did it. I guess that this is not true if these don't commute, but I haven't verified that one way or the other. But it's important to think about this because real-world transformations are only going to approximately satisfy conditions like being a projection or all the other things that we put in our definition of interference experiments. So we better be able to say something about more realistic transformations where we don't know, you know, okay, we could do some tomography maybe to see how close they are to satisfying our assumptions. But if we find out they don't, how do we take account of some tomographic estimate of how far they are from satisfying our assumptions and satisfy ourselves that it's still okay to say we observed interference in this experiment? Maybe we can think about that at this workshop. Okay, I guess I won't get into that. There may be even tweaks to this definition that will allow slightly more general transformations. I'm going to skip this neutral projections business. I'll define it. All right, so I guess it might take me 5 or 10 more minutes to quickly summarize things. Is that all right? Okay. All right, we have some more results in the paper, and they need another assumption about these projections called neutrality. So a projection is neutral if whatever passes it with probability 1 passes it unchanged. So if we take the normalization functional on P omega, and it's equal to the original normalization on omega, then P omega is equal to P omega. Okay, that's not true, for example, of the projection where you take everything to the same state. Right, or like a quantum error correction where you measure the syndrome and then pile all the syndrome subspaces onto the original space. Because, you know, every state might stay normalized, but some of them get changed if they aren't the state you're turning it into. So, and there even exist non-neutral ones whose positive images face. Fine. So with neutrality, you can say a little bit more. If you do tomography on all of the n-1 slit filtered states, you can actually reconstruct the whole state if you don't have nth order interference. So the neutrality is just assuming that information that you needed for the tomography didn't get destroyed. Okay, Jordan algebraic systems, I won't say too much about what they are. Real, complex, and quaternionic quantum theory. Positive, semi-definite, so.
What was the point of the last slide? You used to assume it was neutral, and now you don't.
Didn't
follow the logic.
For this result, if you want to tomographically reconstruct the initial state based on the states that you would get through n minus one slits, you can do it if you don't have nth order interference, but only if the slits are associated with neutral projections. For the earlier thing about the coherence, we didn't care if the projections were neutral or not. Although our initial stronger assumptions that are in Kaz's thesis do assume neutrality. Right. So also we proved this assuming the projections are neutral. I'm pretty sure that we don't need that assumption, but every state space of a simple finitely dimensional formally real Jordan algebra has no third order interference. And what are these? They're ordinary quantum theory, real quantum theory, complex quantum theory, any system whose state space is a ball, which are often called spin factors, and 3x3 Hermitian octonionic matrices. And they've also been characterized in terms of very nice properties, homogeneity and self-duality. I mentioned self-duality already, of the cones. And the simple algebras just correspond to irreducible cones. If you want to take direct sums of them, like super selection sectors without coherence, that's fine. You still can't add interference. So this isn't too surprising, actually, because except for the octonionic ones, you can actually embed these in a larger dimensional complex space as slices through the positive semi-definite cone. So you probably could have proved the thing that way, but I don't know, this is how we did it. I should mention that Gerd Niestege has work on Jordan algebras and higher order interference, and I don't know the details, but so he may have also shown this. Okay, so here's our characterization of quantum theory, which I'll end with. Four postulates. Generalized spectrality. Every state is in the convex hull of a set of perfectly distinguishable pure states. Okay, that's just generalizing the spectral decomposition of quantum states. Strong symmetry. I should have written strong. Every set of perfectly distinguishable pure states transforms to any other such set of the same size reversibly. Right? So if I have a basis, a set of orthogonal projectors corresponding to a basis in of the Hilbert space, I can take it to any other such set of orthogonal projectors by conjugating with the unitary. That's what this second thing generalizes. Very strong symmetry assumption. And here's the interference assumption, no irreducible three-slit interference. Okay, so if we have these three, we already get down to irreducible Jordan algebraic systems and also classical theory, which is a reducible direct sum of trivial Jordan algebraic systems. So we don't have, well, of course we don't have higher order interference. Okay, even the first two give us interesting properties. If we add this other one called energy observability, which maybe isn't so relevant here, we actually pick out standard quantum theory. And it just says that we're going to assume that we have non-trivial, continuously parameterized reversible dynamics. Okay, so we ruled out finite quantum theory, finite classical theory, kind of by fiat. Then the generators of one-parameter continuous subgroups of reversible transformations, which are kind of like Hamiltonians, are associated with non-trivial conserved observables, conserved by that subgroup. Well, actually, they are Hamiltonians because we get complex quantum theory. So for these other theories, they have all kinds of reversible transformations, but there isn't this nice linear association between the Lie algebra that generates those transformations and elements of the states of the effect space. Okay, that this is maybe not so important for higher order interference. I guess I gave the reference before. It's this new JFIS. Okay. I guess this is important. So even these first two axioms mean that every face is the intersection of the positive cone with the image of a very special kind of projection, which we call a filter. And also, in fact, the system is self-dual. The cone is self-dual. But this... So this is a very strong condition.
But it's a consequence of your...
It's a which?
It's a theorem for you, is that right? It's a consequence of your one.
Yes, it's a consequence of one and just one and two.
Just one and two.
And what a filter is, it's the dual of what Alfsain and Schultz call a compression in their geometry of operator algebra. So they have a characterization of Jordan algebraic state spaces. So we go by way of their characterization. I mean, here's what a filter is. It's right? It's a projection, but it's also complemented. So there's some other filter such that, you know, if you pass filter P, you always fail filter P prime, and vice versa. If you, the vice versa, I guess, follows, but if you fail filter P, then you pass filter P prime. Okay, and this has to be true, actually, of the dual as well, the dual of this filter. And then it turns out all kinds of things. You get neutrality. P prime is a unique complement. And so we'll call a state space projective if every face is a positive part of the image of the filter. And these quantum rho goes to Q, rho Q, where Q is the orthogonal projector onto subspace of Hilbert space. Those are examples, kind of canonical examples. The main point of that is that we go via this theorem of Alfsain and Schultz. So they show that if you have a filter for every face and you have symmetry of transition probabilities, all right, so what does that mean? Well, if you have a filter onto every face, it turns out you have a one-to-one map between effects that are one precisely on a single extreme point of the state space and the extreme points on which they are one. And then you can define a transition probability between two states, let's say, by taking the state to its corresponding effect and then evaluating. And then if that bilinear form that gives is symmetric, then you have symmetry of transition probabilities. So you have that in quantum theory. And their third condition is that filters preserve purity. So if omega is a pure state, then P omega is a non-negative multiple of a pure state. So it's in the same extremal ray, right? So even if you're not in the image, in which case you would be preserved because these things are neutral, you still get, if you're pure and you get projected into this other space, you remain pure. Doesn't have to be true in general. So the way we proved this was, well, as I mentioned, we showed that our first two assumptions imply filters on every face and symmetry of transition probabilities, which is essentially trivial once you have self-duality. And then probably the meatiest part is that spectrality and strong symmetry and no higher interference together imply that filters preserve purity. And that means that then we have all the assumptions of Alfsain and Schultz's theorem, and so every we obtain Jordan algebraic systems. And they actually have to be irreducible or classical because of this symmetry. But the main point is we have Jordan algebraic systems because in the context of these other strong axioms, no higher interference already implies that filters preserve purity.
Is pure. Is pure a synonym for extremal?
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have said that. And what we mean by preserving purity is, of course, that it stays on an extremal ray. So I'm using purity as a synonym for being on an extremal ray. And that was really all I had to say, just those two main things, interference arising from higher order coherence and this characterization. So thanks. Yes.
So what is the proposed experiment?
Well, I'm not proposing any particular experiment. This is pretty much experimental, but I mean, I meant to say theoretical. Pretty much theoretical. It's experimental theory. So my proposed experiment is to try to construct nice mathematical models of systems that have higher order interference, preferably that have quantum theory as a subspace within them, onto which there's a positive higher order decoherence projector. And then understanding the structure of these kinds of things might tell you a little bit more about where in actual physics you might expect such things to come from. It's really not very clear to me what kinds of measurements are going to be sensitive to these extra dimensions that are implied by higher order interference. So I actually do think that understanding this theory better might help one get a better idea of which experiments maybe have a little bit better chance of seeing higher order interference. Funny things might happen, like you might say, well, I want to make sure the effects at the final screen have the have the possibility of being sensitive to these extra dimensions, and so maybe I'll actually want them to be fuzzy rather than sharp, because maybe the sharp effects are more likely to project you into the quantum subspace, and fuzzy effects might sort of have more room to also be sensitive to, I'm just thinking about that pillow state space where, I don't know if it's self-dual, it probably isn't, but maybe the effects that are tangent up here, if you always measure them on quantum states, maybe they look like fuzzy effects. And so you might always think, well, of course, I'm going to do the sharpest thing I can at the screen. Maybe that's not the best thing to do. And maybe it's good to put in mixed states, right? I mean, something that would look to a quantum measurement like the maximally mixed state might look to one of these fuzzier measurements that probes the other dimension. I mean, it has the maximal value of this extra, but it could be here or here. Its projection into here looks totally mixed, but it could actually be here. So maybe just thinking about doing experiments that look a little fuzzier or noisier than you might have thought would be ideal. That's pretty speculative, but I think we don't even know if there are any state spaces that satisfy these first two conditions and not, these first two conditions and don't satisfy the third. So that's a challenge for us theorists to try to do it.
May you comment on that? Because that would be really cool to have. They would in a way be very nice models of things that are close to quantum theory very much, but still different from it by having third order interference. And you could look at them and then get actual predictions how far you could be from zero for the third order term or something like that. So it's why it would be interesting to have examples of those, but we don't have them.
Yeah, I mean, these are natural and kind of beautiful mathematical properties, and it would just be, first of all, it would just be totally cool to construct these things from a mathematical point of view, and there's no need to make excuses for that. But also, then if you manage to have quantum theory embedded in there as the image of a positive projector, you'd have a real candidate for an extension of quantum theory that was probabilistically consistent. And I don't know what physics this extra dimensions would be useful for, but conceivably something.
So you say you should maybe start from mixed states, but can we still consider that we can prepare mixed state by preparing two pure states and averaging the results?
You could do that. Just to take a wild guess of like the best way to prepare a mixed state for these purposes, like might be to prepare a pure entangled state and stick in half of it. But again, I'm just speculating because, somehow you want to sort of reveal purity and coherence and dimensions that you didn't know were there originally. Mm-hmm. And so if you prepare your mixed state in a way that's sort of already trying to preserve as much purity as you can, maybe that would be good. Or maybe it would be bad. But I sort of think that, yeah, just doing the equivalent of throwing coins is probably not going to be that useful.
I mean, is it still, so if you have a qubit, you start in a, so you prepare half of the experiment in spin up, half in spin down, mm-hmm. and then you average all these results looking away at which one came from which. Uh-huh. Do we agree that it's the same, still within the theories, it's still the same as actually drawing random numbers?
I would tend to think that that would not tell you much more than just, and would probably tell you less than just sending in the pure states that you made it out of one at a time. I mean, you know, unless there's some kind of weird coherence effects, you know, that your random device is somehow injected into things, which I doubt. So, yeah, I guess, you know, as far as that speculation goes, I would rather send in half of an entangled state than flip a coin and prepare a spin up and spin down. Matthew.
Did you say that it was your second postulate that sort of insisted on irreducibility?
Where? You mean yes. The Jordan algebra. When you add this and get Jordan algebraic systems, the reason they have to be irreducible is because if they're not, you've got these super selection sectors. But remember, we said every pair of distinguishable pure states go to every other by a reversible transformation. But if you pick a pure state from one super selection sector and one from another, those together, the face, they just look like a classical bit. That's the face they generate. Whereas if you have two things in the same one, they're going to have coherence. And so you can't take this classically related pair into a coherently related pair with a reversible transformation. That's why if you're going to have a direct sum, it has to be a direct sum of one-dimensional things. In other words, a classical system.
Raphael. Yeah, you said, or Marcus said, that you didn't find examples of this satisfying one and two without three.
Yeah.
Can you prove that there are, say, no examples in three dimensions or no examples in two dimensions or something? I mean, do you know
how high
a dimension you might have to go to?
If you mean the ambient dimension of the mixed state space,
yeah.
I would imagine that you can. I haven't explicitly thought about it, but Marcus could probably tell you right away.
I'd like tried for an afternoon and had like a hand-waving argument that would be at least an 11-dimensional state space and at least three distinguishable states. But I couldn't really formally prove it, so yeah, kind of gave up on that. But it must have at least three distinguishable states. That's known. Yeah.
And you know, you could have some pretty nice systems, even with slightly less strong properties than these, maybe. But yeah, this would be nice. And it's not known, so there's the theorem there, one way or the other. A good theorem, right? You can either drop an axiom, or you've created some cool things. So, it's a good thing about math. In physics, you have to do the experiment.
I was just wondering about what you said about preparing an entangled state.
Uh-huh.
If you're actually aiming for like the top of that pillow or whatever the corresponding thing is, doesn't that have to be in a product state?
If you want the top of the pillow, now you're really getting the hairy stuff. But sorry, that's a good point. So the point would be that part of the... Yeah, with respect to just making the quantum measurements, it would look like a mixed state. Let's just say weird things can happen when you take composites of systems and you start doing things like relaxing local tomography. You can have things like the tensor product of two pure states is mixed, which, you know, it's kind of weird, but not as weird as you might think once you get used to it.
How long did it take to get used to it?
Well, we wrote a, with Matthew Graydon and Alex Wills, we have a 50-page paper where we construct some composites with this property. So if you take two quaternionic quantum systems or a real and a quaternionic system, and you make a composite according to our recipe, you get this phenomenon, actually. And it's basically because, like a quaternionic pure state, you think of it as embedded in a bigger quantum system, and it's a rank 2 uniform projector. And then when you make the tensor product, the thing becomes real, and you can actually see that rank 2-ness, and you get, in fact, get a rank 4 real state. So it's mixed. See, now I feel used to it. But yeah, on the other hand, if you read the paper, you might not be quite sure whether we're used to it yet. So.
Should we go to the coffee break?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot.